I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk politics. For the past week, Indiana has been the center of the political universe. A presidential primary that is important, if not crucial, to both political parties, and a hotly contested battle for the Republican nomination to the United States Senate have brought waves of media and money to the Hoosier State. We'll talk about what it all means today with my guests. Former Indiana Senate President pro tempore Robert Garten, a Republican, former State Democratic Party Chair Kip Two, and CNN reporter Eric Bradner. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking politics today in honor of the primary going on right now. We hope you all have voted. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are three veterans of the program, starting with Kip Two, who's the former chair of the Indiana Democratic Party. We also have with us from his home in Columbus, Senator Robert Garten, who was the president pro tem leader of the Indiana Senate for more than a quarter century. He's a Republican. And CNN's Eric Bradner. He's also a former Evansville Courier and Press State House Bureau Chief, and probably in the interest of full disclosure, I should say, a former student of mine and was the first guest host this program ever had. Welcome, all of you. Welcome to it's good to have you all here.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us.
Well, this is crazy because, you know, normally Indiana's primary is not a real lively event. And what we had 40-some years between Indiana last really mattering on a national stage and 2008, and now we've had 2008 and this year, 2016, where the primary actually is significant to both parties. What's produced this run of events? Eric, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. So the magic number is 1237. That's the number of delegates it takes to clinch the Republican nomination. And Donald Trump is sort of on razor's edge here. He's going to be very close to that no matter what happens. But Indiana, with its 57 delegates, could tip this Trump's way. Without Indiana, it gets a lot harder to see the math adding up to 1237. So because of the way this is shaken out, whether Trump wins Indiana or not probably decides whether the Republican nomination is decided at a contested convention or beforehand. So the stakes couldn't be much higher, and it's hard to remember the last time Indiana played a bigger role in a Republican nominating contest. Not as hard to remember on the Democratic side.
No. 2000 was part of that.
Yeah. Right. And frankly, in 2008, when President Obama, then Senator Obama, and then Senator Clinton were running against each other, the contest was actually a lot closer than it is right now. Bernie Sanders is much farther behind than Hillary Clinton was in 2008, and it looks like there is no real way for him to catch up. But he's still running, right? So he plans to stay in the race through the June 7th California primary and then take as many delegates as he can to the DNC in Philadelphia, hoping to influence the party platform, that sort of thing. So two contested primaries, two close primaries. And on the Democratic side, you can't ignore the fact that Bernie Sanders has spent $1.5 million here in Indiana, whereas Hillary Clinton hasn't. She hasn't spent anything at all. So it's a big state on the Democratic side, too.
Senator Garten, how does the fact that that Donald Trump is really within in sight of being the Republican presidential nominee make traditional Republicans such as yourself feel?
Well, it's such an unconventional campaign that he's conducted, and he has created a persona that, look, I'm the honest one. I'm the one that's telling the truth, and a lot of people have bought into that, that he's the one that's going to really make a change. He's going to build a wall. Another country's going to pay for it. And any companies leaving America for manufacturing in other countries, they will pay a very steep price. And that concerns a lot of people, the fact that jobs have been lost to overseas companies, no question. So he's tapped into some very deep-seated emotions that a number of people at all income levels have felt for apparently some time. So I give a lot of the credit for the turnout to Donald Trump, rightly or wrongly.
Kip, I'm going to ask, because Senator Garton's alluded to the fact here that that there's a lot of anger floating around out there. And in some ways, 2008, the message was, well, I mean, the winning message ultimately was about hope and change.
Yes.
With Barack Obama's successful campaign for the White House, make an argument that, you know, by a lot of indicators, things are better than they were 8 years ago, but people seem to be a lot angrier. I mean, at some level, this contest has, on both sides, has evolved into a campaign to see who's the maddest. What accounts for that?
Well, I think you're seeing a confluence of a couple of things. First of all, is I think we're at the pyramid, the top of the pyramid for reality TV, and it being sort of the star of the thing. No offense to my fellow person over here today who is with us, but Donald Trump has been fueled almost entirely by cable TV and the network news. He's gotten, I think, double to triple the amount of coverage of any candidate this cycle. And he hasn't had to spend his own money to do that. And he is a showman first. He was a TV star. And so he has a pretty good comprehension of what it takes to get attention in the election cycle. And with respect to the anger, you know, there's been a I think it's the last vestige, really, of the fear that's been out there and been manifesting itself for a long time in this country that people wanted to say doesn't exist and that we've moved beyond it. We're post-racial and all those things, and it's clear that we're not. And this is those folks having one more stab at the apple, really. I think that's the confluence of both of those things. Trump, who is a master showman, and getting and figuring out a way to completely manipulate the major networks and the major cable TV companies to constantly cover him. And so he has drowned out virtually everybody else's ability to compete with him on television.
Eric, I'm going to throw that one your way because in some ways you've been you've been invoked there, at least your employer has. One way to look at this is, though, is to say that I mean, a large part of politics, and we've all been around it, is figuring out ways to leverage earned media rather than the media you have to pay for. And by any measure, Trump has been. Donald Trump has been spectacularly successful.
Mm-hmm. He has.
At that. What accounts for the fascination with him? Because presumably it's a business, right, where you wouldn't be, none of the networks would be showing as much of Donald Trump if he weren't pulling eyeballs every time he's on.
So, yeah, Kip's point is well taken. And we are in a bit of an era of pop politics. But it's also worth pointing out that Donald Trump, for better or worse, is much less cautious than other politicians, not just on the stump when he's railing about whatever comes to mind, but in terms of his accessibility to media. I remember early in the campaign, it was a lot easier to get Donald Trump on the phone than somebody like Bobby Jindal, right? a low-level sort of Republican candidate.
No kidding.
Seriously. So
too much caution.
Right, absolutely. Yes. He's exploiting a lot of sort of weaknesses in the system and weaknesses in the political gene. And he's been very successful at that. And you also have to give Trump a bit of credit for having this instinct for what people, at least people in the Republican primary electorate, especially as he called them, poorly educated people without college degrees, people in manufacturing states who have seen their jobs go away, who have not really benefited from the economic recovery because it's a lot of the wealth has been concentrated toward the top. He really does get those people, and perhaps his solutions are a placebo or are utterly unrealistic, but he's still speaking to them in a way that that other candidates have not.
And he's not being held accountable for the things that he says in a way any other politician ever has been. The perfect example I have for you is just this last week, where he came to Indianapolis and decided to praise convicted rapist Mike Tyson. I'm sorry, yeah, it's not humorous to me.
No, I know that, but I'm just thinking. Yeah.
And he, I don't think he, Eric, you've been following him much closer, but I don't think he talked about Mike Tyson anywhere else. And
right.
Mike Tyson was convicted of rape in our city, mm-hmm. and he brings it up in this city. Any other politician who, you know, if it was an accident, I don't think it was. I think it was on purpose. Any other politician had done anything remotely like that, it would have been 10 days of nonstop stories. We recall in the 2008 election when Reverend Jeremiah Wright mm-hmm. burst onto the scene. It was a week of the most intense focus on Barack Obama and his pastor. It dominated it right before the Indiana primary, that conversation. Trump says something like this. Clearly sending a dog signal to misogynists, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the national press has not spent the time on it, not even close to the time on it that they should. And the local press, one of our columnists said that this guy has been steady this week, that Donald Trump has been steady compared to Kasich and Cruz this week. And I was really outraged by that column and continue to be outraged because it isn't steady to do a dog whistle to a misogynist audience.
Well, let me step in and ask Senator Garton, I mean, part of the reason I was chuckling is that not at the comment, but the fact that this has only been the most recent example of Trump being able to sort of survive things that that one would think would have crippled candidates from earlier eras. I mean, some of the stuff obviously about immigrants, about Muslims, about women in general. He's made statements like that repeatedly that not only don't seem to hurt him, but at least with a certain branch of the Republic seem to enhance his appeal to them. What do you think accounts for that, Senator Garton?
That's a good point, John. He even criticized John McCain for being imprisoned over in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
It was just remarkable. And time after time, I said, well, that does it. He's finished. He can't continue. I mean, I can just see the commercials now. And even if they're running the commercials against him, it doesn't seem to make a big difference. It's just fascinating that we live through this period of time. This will be an election year that will be written about and talked about for perhaps decades because it's just a fascinating one. There is another group, though, that I think bears a heavy burden, and it has not performed well for the last several years, U.S. Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Obama, President Obama, well, he may be unpopular, but his rating, approval ratings are almost three times that of Congress. Congress is down to a 17% approval rating, and I think it's been lower than that because Congress simply is not functioning. People after a while begin to resent that. They want a government that at least functions and does something. And so I think Congress bears a heavy burden and more than the share of the blame that others may have.
How much, Eric Bradner, and we're getting a little bit tight on time, how much of this is sort of the logical conclusion of the cul-de-sac that conservatives have marched themselves into with their opposition to all that Barack Obama stands for.
Well, you can sort of draw a straight line from the from 2011 when Donald Trump was fomenting the birther controversy, for example, and yet Mitt Romney was eagerly seeking his endorsement to today. It's from the moment Obama took office, Republicans sought to delegitimize him, and Donald Trump was better at it than most because he would go places that other influential Republicans wouldn't quite go. So here we are.
We are talking about politics on primary day here in on No Limits. My guests are Kip Tu, who's a Democrat, Senator Robert Gartner, Republican, and CNN's Eric Bratner. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking politics today on No Limits because it is primary day. We hope everyone has gone out to vote. My guests are Kip Tu, who's the former chairman of the Indiana Democratic Party, Bob Garten, who is the longest-serving president pro tem or legislative leader in Indiana's history. He's a Republican, and CNN's Eric Bratner. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named AJ has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. AJ, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I know you've been talking nationally. I'd like to shift attention back to Indiana. I voted this morning on the Democratic primary, and there were virtually no candidates on the slate. Democrats don't run. They don't get the support in this state. And as long as that ends, and more importantly, perhaps, is that some of the folks who run as Democrats, John Gregg, for example, Barron Hill, 20 years ago would have been Republicans on any ticket. And it's very, very frustrating to find a Democratic Party so inert.
Thanks very much for the call and the comments, AJ. Kip, I think we'll throw that one your way since you get to catch the spears for the Democratic Party today.
Well, 20 years ago, Barron Hill and John Gregg were Democrats. one was the Speaker of the Indiana House, and the other one, I think, was a congressman. So they've been consistent Democrats throughout their entire career. But I think the caller makes a good point in that they are conservative Democrats. And I think part of the issue here for the state of Indiana, if we just want to talk about it in specific, is on a larger if you take the further view back, conservative Republicanism has pushed the dialogue for just about everything but gay rights to the right in this country over the course of the last 20 years. They've been particularly successful in moving the rhetoric and moving all of politics to the right. And I think that's part of the Bernie Sanders coming back in, and the real benefit to our democracy and to my party, the Democratic Party, is pushing us back to the middle and pushing and talking about issues that I think have long been in the background, and he's brought them up to the forefront. And it's been very healthy. I think the Democratic Party here in the state of Indiana is going to do very well here in November. I think John Gregg is going to be the next governor of the state of Indiana, and I think Barron Hill has a great shot at helping take over the Senate, particularly if either Cruz or Trump are the Republican nominee. I think that there's going to be a big backlash.
Senator Garten, has this drift to the right been a good thing for the Republican Party or not?
It started out being a good thing, but it became a bit extreme. And that turned a lot of people off. They picked issues that, had religious themes to them. And we have a variety of religions throughout this state. And whenever you get into deep social issues, you tap emotional roots. And, that became a problem to me for the party when it became so extreme. And then when it wasn't conservative enough, another branch started called the Tea Party. and they identified themselves with Republicans and found a lot of supporters and pulled themselves to that part of the line, if you will. Now we may be swinging back. We go in cycles in this country. I remember when Johnson County was a very strong Democratic county. Now it's a very strong Republican county. And by contrast, or if you will, Lake County, strong Democratic county today, at one time was a very strong Republican county. So we go in cycles. History teaches us that lesson.
I've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Elise. And if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. She says, you discussed the amount of airtime given to Trump and then proceeded to add to the problem. That's a fair point, Elise. We're going to take that one into consideration. Would you please rise above that and cover all other candidates equally on your show today? The other part of this, and I think it is the other side to that question, has been the emergence, really, of Bernie Sanders. I mean, if you look at it, if you look back, we're projecting this thing out 2 years ago, you'd think, okay, an independent senator from a small state, you know, who would pride himself on saying, I'm a democratic socialist, would not play well. Right. Yet he has given Hillary Clinton all she can handle and probably a lot more than she would have liked along the way. How did that happen, Eric?
Well, I think the existence of both Bernie Sanders and, sorry, at least Donald Trump, in this contest has taken us to a point where voters in both parties, BS detectors with normal politics, with regular politicians, have been set off in a way that perhaps they haven't been before, in part because of who Bernie Sanders is. He's this guy with this thick Brooklyn accent. He's frankly disheveled looking. He gives these speeches that are an hour and 15 minutes, and he calls them boring. And it's hard to see him as anything but genuine, right? And so it's a little easier for people who are fed up with politics as usual, with the reality of poll tested lines, et cetera, it's a little easier for them to buy into what he's selling because they believe in him, even if he's not the kind of character straight out of central casting.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add this: had you not had Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton as the front runners a year ago, I don't think you'd have Donald Trump or you'd have Bernie Sanders in the positions that they are today. Both, I think, brought real baggage to the race. Neither of them, I would say, is completely of their own making, but being, you know, the third Bush in the last 25 years to run for office brings with it baggage. Hillary Clinton having her husband serve in office for 8 years and doing that, it's just sort of a natural, I think, evolution of why people are like, well, you know, we fought a war against England to get away from monarchy here, so why are our two leading candidates, it looks to be like they're, you know, a case of primogeniture. And so I think that was part of it. And I really do believe if Jeb Bush had not run, you'd have seen other quality Republican candidates come to the fore, and all the money that Jeb Bush got early on that ended up being completely wasted. And Trump was able to – I'm sorry to keep doing this to you. Elise.
Really, Elise, we are trying to bring it back to other points.
But the point is he wouldn't have, I think, have been as successful. And Bernie really – I think there would have been other Democrats in the race had Hillary Clinton decided not to run. There's a lot of people, I think, on the bench in our party that sat it out because they didn't want to take on Hillary, and they rightly, I think, assumed that the White House and people around them and the infrastructure of the Obama campaign, many of the folks that worked on the Obama campaign last time have now signed on for Hillary. It was going to be a very, very uphill battle, and none of the A-teams were willing to take it on. You had Cuomo not run. You had Sherrod Brown not run. You had Elizabeth Warren, although I'm not sure Elizabeth Warren really wants to be president. Mm. But the other people that like that are that would have been very good presidential candidates sat it out.
I've gotten an email question from a listener named Marion that sort of synthesizes one also from Jennifer. And Marion's made a point that a couple of people have made coming in, says, I've heard statistics that 85% of Americans are dissatisfied with the current system. Locally, Trump and Bernie Sanders are speaking for those of us who have very little choice in voting. Locally, we have no Democratic state senator running and only Republican commissioners. Even nationally, without Bernie, Hillary represents corporate America and the agricultural establishment, devastating our rural communities. It seems our entire election process is hopeless, and at least Trump is making the election exciting. This, by the way, illustrates at some level that that I know, because Marion's a regular listener, that her sympathies are not with Donald Trump. So the fact that that a lot of people are seeing him, and she mentions Bernie Sanders as well, as a vehicle, speaks to not just anger at one party or the other, but anger at the idea of an establishment altogether. And Senator Garton, I'm going to toss this one to you because you spent a lot of time in the legislature. Anger at the sort of work that professional politicians and legislators just have to do, the idea of compromising and working through differences, is that problematic in the long haul?
I don't think so. It has become problematic in the last several years, John. You can't get anything done in most elected bodies without some form of compromise. Even within parties, you have major disagreements. You simply have to work through them. And again, Congress, it started about, 7.5 years ago when the majority leader, or the leader of the, at that time, of the U.S. Senate, Senator Mitch McConnell, said his number one priority was making sure that President Obama only had one term. Well, that set the climate for that 4 years and for the following 3.5 years. So no compromise. And I believe that you cannot govern without compromise. Throughout history, that's why the D.C. Capitol is in D.C. because of a compromise.
Right.
That's why we have a Bill of Rights, too, for that matter.
You wouldn't have that without a compromise. So,
you wouldn't have slavery abolished.
You can't govern without it, and we've almost reached the point right now where a compromise means surrender. The government doesn't work that way and will not work that way.
We are talking about the primary here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. Just want to say first time, long time, and I love
Thank
the
you.
Show.
Thank
and
you.
And my question is kind of more of a statement. It's kind of a question to Mr. Tu. Just wanted to just kind of put this out there. I too, am frustrated with the lack of Democratic candidates, that I've seen on both the statewide level and the local level. And I'm very frustrated with what I see as a failure by the state Democratic Party to come up with any sort of strategy to find more Democratic candidates out in the rest of the state. I understand that Marion County and Lake County are very well taken care of, but to me, it's almost malpractice that we don't seem to have any sort of strategy to take back some of these rural districts. The Bernie people have shown me that there are Democrats out there, and I just don't feel like, as a ground-level activist, we are trying to take advantage or to put ourselves out there in some of these outlying counties that have been Republican for years. Where are the city county candidates in some of these outlying rural counties? Where are some of these Democratic candidates in places like Hamilton County? It's completely inexcusable to me that we are not putting.
Let me try to address
it. David, thanks very much.
I appreciate the concern. Let me say this: I've got a good friend of mine, a former state representative, Dave Crooks, who is the county chairman in Daviess County in Indiana. He begs people to run. It's a difficult county for Democrats to win. It's a pretty hard Republican county. He has won that county before as a state representative, but it's really hard for someone to want to put their name on the ballot when they have a pretty good sense they're going to get their head kicked in. But I will say Howard Dean said it had a 50-state strategy prior to 2008, and it really did benefit Democrats up and down the ticket. I think you do have to try to compete everywhere you can. And the other part of that is the Dean movement led to the Obama movement, and the Obama movement, people, the biggest cancer, the biggest danger in democracy is cynicism, thinking you don't have any opportunity to make a change, thinking that your voice never counts, that money is the only thing that matters. That cynicism, while well-founded, perpetuates itself and becomes a cancer. And so the thing that I really like about the Bernie campaign, the thing that really inspired me about the Obama campaign and Dean campaign, brought new people into the system. A lot of them stayed and remade the Democratic Party. Here in this county, most of the people that are precinct committee people and do the work here in this county were Obama people who had never been involved in politics before. So that cynicism you have to fight every single day. There's very good reason for it. I understand it completely, but it doesn't help because it perpetuates itself if you just continue to believe it. And
how much of this, I'm going to step in and I'd like everybody's thoughts on this. How much of this, though, is produced by gerrymandering, by the fact that so few of these legislative districts actually are competitive now? Eric, I'm going to start with you because you're nodding, but sure. I want to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
Certainly a lot of it. And gerrymandering's tough because, you know, first of all, what do you do about it? I mean, how do you set goals in terms of drawing districts? Do you decide you want communities of interest together? Well, Democrats tend to live closer together to each other than Republicans do. Do you want competitive districts? Well, that forces awkward-looking districts. Do you want to take it out of the hands of elected officials and give it to an independent body? Well, then voters have no way to sort of respond to poorly drawn districts. It's certainly part of it, and it's a tough problem to solve. I also want to get back to the previous point, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Statewide, Democrats need to hope that either Barron Hill or John Gregg wins this time, or else it will be another wasted election for Indiana Democrats. These sort of conservative Democrats who have the field cleared for them and then run on a platform of I'm not Mike Pence or I'm not Marlon Stutzman or Todd Young don't inspire many people. And we've seen with the Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton primary and with the Barack Obama-Hillary Clinton primary that you can bring a lot of new energy and talent and enthusiasm into the party with a contested race. But Indiana Democrats on the statewide level have not had a true liberal who's even lost to choose in a while. I think someone like Pete Buttigieg in South Bend might be a compelling statewide candidate for the future. But this is another year where one doesn't quite exist.
Senator Garton, how much of the problem is gerrymandering?
Well, let's put it in historical perspective. In the 1970s, Republican controlled the redistricting program, if you will, or the legislature. About mid-70s, the House went Democratic, and the Senate lost seats. 1980s, again, Republicans were in charge. The House lost control. The Senate got down to one vote. 1990s, it changed back again. And the same in the first decade of this century. Control did change within that 10-year span. So it's fascinating. You can talk about an independent commission, but how do you ever get an independent commission? And if you don't like the redistricting, you can always vote out those who voted for it. So I think it's a dilemma, but it may be a situation that really is not what it appears to be, that folks do change their minds. They do change parties. The entire South, Democratic area, now a Republican area, going back to the civil rights legislation and when Lyndon Johnson signed it, said we've lost the South forever, even though it passed with strong Republican support at the federal level. So times change, people change, attitudes change.
And I'll tell you what, we're going to get Kip Tu's thoughts on that after the break. We are talking about politics on primary day here in Indiana. My guests are Kip Tu, who's the former chair of the Indiana Democratic Party, former Indiana Senate President Pro Tem Robert Garten, he's a Republican, and CNN's Eric Bradner. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about politics on primary day here in Indiana. My guests are Kip Tu, the former chair of the Indiana Democratic Party, former Senator Robert Garten, who was the president pro tem of the Indiana Senate for more than a quarter century, longest serving legislative leader in the state's history. He is a Republican, and CNN's Eric Bradner. Just before we went to the break, I asked about the whole gerrymandering redistricting question. Heard Eric's thoughts. Heard Senator Garten's. Kip?
Well, I have great respect for Senator Garten, obviously, and I think he is defending a system that he participated in, and as have I participated in the past. But we have had several states now that have gone to commissions, independent commissions. I do think that they may be superior to what we have devised. I think because of the advancement in computer technology, the ability to draw these districts in such a way that makes it even less likely for there to be competition is a problem. But I participated in gerrymandering and have been a happy participant. Senator Garten's right when he takes the long view of it, that people's minds change and they don't have as much long-term effect as you might think.
If you would like to join the conversation, we're talking about politics, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John, and I applaud you for having the nerve to put this show on today.
that's sort of what we do. There's a reason we call it No Limits.
In that vein, I'm a little off the wall as usual, or maybe the handwriting's on the wall for me. I think the reason the American voters are so upset, so unhappy, so angry is because of what's been going on so many years. I mean, we've gone into wars for no apparent reason. I mean, the outcomes were for no apparent reason. And people are hurting. I read a book last Christmas, and it took me a while to get through it, 500 and some pages, by David Talbot. And the name of the book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and America's Secret Government. And I feel like it should be required reading for every American. I've always been a conspiracy theorist, but I don't believe it's theory if the facts line up. And in this book, the facts line up. And it's just I think American people are feeling what's going on. They just can't put their fingers on all of it. WBRI in Boston had a show on the other night about El Salvador, the murders that are going on there because of the drug trade. A caller called in and said, if you think it's bad in El Salvador, you should come to Honduras. And Honduras, I guess, has the same thing going on. What's happening there? This fellow was a Harvard graduate from Honduras, and he said people are being murdered in Honduras, and there is a U.S.-supported dictator in power there. And once these people are disposed off their lands, then American corporations are going in and taking control and setting up their businesses. And it's just, that's how bad it is. And I think that's the popularity of Bernie Sanders. He's outside that loop. He's not a player in all that. And I think people realize that. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, man. Certainly, Ron. Thank you for the call and for the comments. What we're really talking about here, Senator Garten, though, and if there's a theme, we were sort of chatting during the break, is there does seem to be a theme to a lot of these calls and to, in some ways, the sense that people feel disenfranchised, distanced from their government. What can we do about that? I mean, how can How can government officials begin to restore this trust that does seem to be broken?
Oh, it's a good point, and it's very valid. And it's a very shrewd observation, John. We have lost confidence in ourselves and our government, and that's most unfortunate. I think one of the real contributions that President John Kennedy and President Ronald Reagan made was restored confidence in America. Now, you can agree or disagree with their policies. You can even evaluate, did they really achieve a whole lot? But they made Americans feel good about themselves. And if you will, it picked up the Trump theme, make America great again. I think that has great appeal. I think that's why we're seeing this surge of voters supporting him.
Before we move on, I should say we've also gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named John that applies to you, says, we need leaders like Senator Garton again. So I thought you'd want to hear that, Senator Garton.
Very nice.
Yeah. We also have gotten, and I'm going to throw this one to Kip, a Twitter question that says, I'm a mid-30s liberal and interested in running for office. Where should I start?
Well, it probably depends on where you live, but wherever you live is probably where you ought to start. That's generally a good thing, but we're seeing down in the in one congressional district, a guy didn't live anywhere near it, and he's trying to buy a congressional seat. So it may not always be good advice. If you got a lot of money, have your daddy do ads on your behalf, I suppose, is another way to get started. I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit of a smarty pants on that. But no, I would say wherever it is that you live, get involved in somebody else's campaign is the first thing. Because you can learn a lot being involved on the ground with campaigns, learn how it's done. That's my best advice. Find somebody locally that you like to support, learn from them, and then see where opportunities exist.
And I don't think Kip's talking about joining the establishment here. We're talking about figuring out how to get yard signs right, how to get a website, like some very basic fundamental things.
How to go door to door.
Right.
Isn't there I remember, wasn't there like a Wellstone school in Minnesota where they would in effect try to train insurgent candidates named after Paul and Sheila Wellstone.
Yes.
Who was the senator there. We've gotten an email from a listener who is Canadian. He's from Montreal and says his
wow.
name is Frank, the reach of this program, no limits applies in all sorts of ways. And he walks through, it's too long for me to read aloud, Frank. I apologize for that. But he says basically that, you know, Donald Trump doesn't know anything about the trade or real challenges confronting our country. He does not trust Ted Cruz or much that Ted Cruz has to say. And he has questions about Bernie Sanders and how he's going to break up big banks and, you know, how is he going to make sure that education is free, because that would bankrupt the country within 5 years? And Frank, I'm gonna synthesize here. I hope I'm not taking liberties, but the overarching theme he's asking is, on behalf of much of the rest of the world, is, are we Americans nuts right now? Have we collectively lost our minds? I'll throw that one to you, Eric, because I know you talk to an awful lot of overseas media.
Yeah, so. Yeah, maybe a little bit. no, seriously, people have, for the last few years, felt that, sure, there's an economic recovery, but things are not getting better for them. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, you know, the end of the movie, The Big Short, features a character saying that, this is what always happens when the economy crashes. They wait a few years and then nothing changes, and they blame immigrants and poor people. So Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are offering a lot of prescriptions for the problems that ail America. Now, are these fully thought out? Are these, you know, prescriptions that could ever be implemented by Congress? Perhaps not. But they're talking about a lot of things that have been frustrating people for a long time, and that many Democrats and Republicans have not been addressing. So it remains to be seen whether, you know, America will sort of sober up in time for the general election and demand different things out of both parties' presidential candidates. But perhaps that's a start to the answer.
Kip.
Yeah. I recommend to your readers taking a look at yesterday's New York Magazine and the article by Andrew Sullivan. It was a brilliant article. I got about 90% through it. I'm not completely finished, but he makes what I think are some really compelling points about, and he goes back to Plato, believe it or not. They'll think you probably hear Plato on No Limits today, but he quotes Plato as saying, "Tyranny is probably established out of no other regime than democracy." That's a quote from Plato. And, of course, the roots of our democracy come from Plato, Socrates, and the Greeks. And they knew way back then that tyranny could come from it. And I do think we are at a dangerous moment in American history that we have to be vigilant about. And all the folks out there that have been calling and writing in about being cynical, it's not a time to turn off. It's a time to engage, because if you turn off and disengage, then you're going to get what you deserve.
Right. I mean, Plato's point was about late-stage democracies, right? Democracies nearing their ends,
right.
Being ripe for takeover by a demagogue. And Sullivan's point is that that's Trump. But really setting this up as a moment to sort of save the democracy.
We are talking about politics and primary day. We've got a lot of calls, emails, and all of that. I'm going to take a call right now. I'm going to ask all of our listeners, if you could, try to be concise because we're getting tight on time here. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi. Indiana has a miserable voter turnout, and I think there's a process thing that could be addressed. I probably won't be, but it's the idea of winner take all. So in the primaries, if you're a Republican and polling contributes to this as well, you look at the polls and you just wonder how you can contribute. If your guy doesn't, if he's 40%, the other guy is 60%, you get nothing. Same in the general election for the president. Most Democrats in Indiana, in most presidential election cycles, just question what the point is, because they could be 49-51, but you get nothing in terms of electoral votes.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jack. Kip, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, I'm not a big believer in the Electoral College. I think that it was denied Al Gore the presidency in the year 2000, also the United States Supreme Court. But it was put into place by the founders for a reason, and the reason was it was designed to be sort of a cooler for democracy, for forces that can be negative, and it's to calm those forces. And so that was the purpose for the Electoral College. As we've moved to greater democracy in our country, because the Constitution itself was a democratic instrument, but it wasn't completely democratic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are a republic.
Mm-hmm.
We are not direct election of the president, and they did that for a reason. As we have gained in primaries, because it used to be, you know, we picked our presidential candidates at the convention. There really weren't primaries. The elites in each state got together and nominated folks, and they had a big fight about who it was going to be. I think Lincoln won on the 20th ballot or something in his convention.
Yeah.
That's why the Electoral College is there. It's a good and a bad thing altogether, I think.
Well, and it also has had the effect. Of making the voters' verdicts look more decisive than they might be otherwise.
Correct.
That, you know, 53-47 is actually fairly close, but 53-47 with the electoral votes can look like a landslide.
One of the things that really offended me the most was, after Bush was installed as the president of the United States, he governed from the right rather than governing from the center, full knowing that the country did not support him as a majority. But Karl Rove's strategy was, we're going to play to the base, and I thought it was offensive.
Yeah, good point about the conventions too. We moved away from conventions because too many candidates and too many decisions were being made, smoke-filled back rooms. It was corrupt. So let's go to the direct primary. And now, just the opposite occurring. Let's get rid of the direct primary and go back to conventions. It's fascinating, isn't it?
How these things cycle. Let me ask this, because after a long period of slumbering in Indiana, primaries not really mattering all that much. Now, two within the space of a relatively short period of time have been important, in some cases even decisive. I mean, here's where, even though technically he lost the primary in 2008, this was the place where Barack Obama secured the nomination and the route to the presidency. Clearly important decisions are going to be made here. Is this the new norm, or does Indiana go back and take another 40-year slumber before we matter again? Senator Garton, I'll get your thoughts
first.
Well,
it's fun to listen to the networks and the cable shows and hear about Indiana. They have discovered our state. It is fun. Good for Hoosiers.
I would say that I've been advocating for a while to no avail that we move our primary up so that we are part of the debate early, because I think it's an important thing for the state to be a part of it. We are the exception. I mean, for us to be a part of it is an exception, not the rule. And I think it does disservice to the voters of Indiana and to the politicians of Indiana, because they don't have quite the access to the presidents once they get elected that other states get because the states are deemed important.
Eric,
Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are the exception, not the norm. So it's a little too soon to tell. It'll take another election or two before we know if this is a trend where the two strong candidates can last this deep into the contest. The rules right now are set up to end things early, especially on the Republican side. Just hasn't worked that way.
Well, and we've only got a couple of minutes here, but I should ask real quickly. We've talked almost exclusively about the presidential races, and to some degree that illustrates, Elise, again, your point. There are a lot of other races going on
sure
here
are.
In Indiana, including, you know, a hotly contested U.S. Senate primary between Todd Young and Marlon Stutzman, 9th District Republican primary.
3rd District.
And they're all right now, all of the oxygen's been drained out of the room because of this presidential contest. What does that do to those campaigns?
The Senate race is really probably should be the most fascinating of the evening, because you've got what most people consider the establishment Republican in Todd Young going against Marlon Stutzman, who is an unabridged Tea Party or social conservative. And it looks to me like Todd Young is probably going to pull that out. And it is a big win for the Republican establishment in Indiana if that does happen, because that's who they wanted. And none of the establishment people I know like Donald Trump for an instant. So they'll have something to hang their hat on, but I think it will be temporary, because I think Barron Hill is going to be a very difficult candidate for Todd Young in the fall. Todd's got a lot of bad votes out there that do not align with the middle of the country.
Todd Young would be big for Mitch McConnell, too. He's been very involved in this race, a lot of national interest from the Republican Party in it.
What's going to be Eric, I'll give you the last word on this because we are running out of time. What's going to be the legacy of this primary for Indiana, would you say?
The outcome of the Republican presidential primary will be potentially decisive in terms of whether Donald Trump is able to win the nomination before the convention. That's the big takeaway here. But Kip is right. I mean, the Senate primary is important, too, because we could be talking about somebody who will be in office for several terms.
Well, I think that is going to have to be the last word, although I feel like we could have very easily done 2 hours on this subject today. I'd like to thank my guests, Kip Tu, Robert Garton, and Eric Bradner, for what's been a fascinating conversation. I also would like to thank all of our listeners who sent in great questions, offered great comments and stories. I'm sorry we did not have time to get to all of them. I hope you'll come back and listen again and share your thoughts in the future. On Thursday, we're going to be talking about Next Indiana Campfires, a pairing of Indiana literature and wilderness. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.